This is Everything is Workable, the podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm talking to other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is part two with Heather Ordover, who was my guest last week. As a former American Lit teacher and the host of Craft Lit, she has a lot of book recommendations, and it felt best to just do an entire show on these. If you enjoy this episode, please share it. Your support in getting this in front of an ever wider audience is hugely appreciated. You can also visit CaitlinSCHatch.com to leave a tip, which will help support the show. And now, on to my conversation with Heather. Books!
Yes!
Books.
Books.
We're going to talk about books.
I love books.
I love books as well. I try to read 52 books a year, and I try to mix it up quite a lot, and I've become better about branching out and diversifying, and I know that can be a problem for people, actually. I think that for a really long time, I only read fiction. I hated nonfiction. I thought it was boring.
I got better.
I think it's about finding the right nonfiction.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people's exposure to nonfiction is in school, where it's things that you're told you should read. And also actually just generally a lot of people's exposure to reading, and why there's a lot of people who don't read, because they've been forced to read, and usually forced how to think about something, and that's forced into a particular understanding.
Yep. Yep. I'm sensing a theme.
I know. This is really just your chance to talk about fabulous books that are worth reading for the sake of just reading them, and for people to have their own interpretations and their own understanding as a way to, because like there's a study, I can't cite it right now, but I know that there's a study that the more the people read fiction, the better they become at empathizing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And yeah, knowledge, information, it's great. And there's lots of really fabulous books out there. So what do you recommend and why?
So it's so interesting that you start with that, because as we have talked about before, both of us are, I don't know if excited is the right word, but certainly not unhappy to find out that we were wrong about something.
Yes.
And that, oh, wow, the world is a bigger and more interesting place. And the people who I thought were just downright evil are actually kind of quirky. And we have some zones of commonality, and that's kind of cool. I think we're probably freaks because of that, but I don't think that we're solo freaks. I think there's actually quite a lot of us out there, but we're very quiet about it. So that stretch of, I mostly read fiction. Okay, well, I guess people keep talking to me about the Dancing Wooly Masters. So finally, I'm going to break down and read the Dancing Wooly Masters. And oh my God, that book is so weird and interesting, and it's about physics, and I never took physics, but that's okay, because I understand the world, the universe, consciousness, all sorts of things in a very different way that is both in one sense very, oh, it kind of, you know, came out during the new agey thing in Southern California when I was still living there, but it also is grounded in science. Mm-hmm. and it just made me think and start to question, and not question authority or question anything like that. It wasn't an aggressive kind of questioning. It was the curiosity questioning. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those books that really did it for me. There was also another one, which is technically an autobiography, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which I tried reading probably 7,000 times. I think that's a conservative estimate. 7,000 times. I probably tried to read it 7 times, and it just never caught. Uh-huh. And then finally, I think I just got old enough. I started reading it, and I could not put it down. It was heartbreaking. And I don't think I'd ever had my heart broken by a nonfiction-y kind of autobiography.
Really?
Yeah. It may have been the first one that really hit me as both beautiful and fragile and heartbreaking and fascinating. I was thinking about that last night. That had been a big one. Stephen Jay Gould. because he was one of the freaks kind of like us that he liked being surprised. And I remember when I started teaching in New York, I needed a nonfiction text that was going to be hard but interesting. And I needed it to be hard, really hard. And my husband came back and handed me a book and said, I think this one section that I marked is one that'll work really well for your students. And it was Stephen Jay Gould took all of the, there was a name for them. It was during the whole eugenics thing in the 1800s, okay. But it was the group of people who were trying to prove that white folks were smarter than pretty much everybody else on the planet. And one of the ways that this one doctor decided to do it, but it was a famous study, was he was going to use BBs, shot pellet, and fill a Caucasian skull with pellets. And then fill an African skull with pellets. And he was going to prove brain size that way, which is, I thought, kind of a creative way to do it.
Kind of a creative way, but also before we understood that brain size has nothing to do with intelligence.
Well, it's a man saying size matters, and you know. So it was so interesting to read Stephen Jay Gould go about recreating the experiment and being able to prove pretty conclusively that, just like we keep talking about confirmation bias these days, that it was the same thing going on in the experiment, that without realizing that he was doing it, probably, the scientist was tamping the shot down a little harder in the Caucasian skull to fit more in. Mm-hmm. And whether he knew he was doing it or not kind of doesn't matter. It's how that particular experiment wound up being done. And of course, it wasn't replicable, which should bring pause.
Mm-hmm. Just when you say hard, and you said that you wanted something that was going to be really hard, mm-hmm. kind of have an idea of what you might mean by that. But I think that hard is one of those things that needs to be a bit unpacked in this context. So what did you mean by that? I think I know where you're going, but
I needed something. No, it's a really important question, actually, because you're right. What I think of as hard is probably not what most people would think of. I needed something that was going to be fascinating and hook them and not let them go, and was going to give them things to think about that might be uncomfortable, but would be worth wrestling with. But I also needed it to be written at a level of complexity that would give them a different kind of payoff when we were done with it, where it was something that they could look back on and say, damn, I read that thing and I understood that thing. And now I can go on and do any hard old thing because, you know, we made it through that. And now I know how to approach a text like that. So it had to be written well. It had to be written with complex structure. It had to be something that I could point at and say, that's an essay, because it doesn't look like the essays that they write for school. They needed to know that every essay doesn't have 5 paragraphs.
Right. Yes.
So I really needed something that could be hard for them in a good way on many levels.
When you say Stephen Jay Gould, mm-hmm. there's this specific essay, but really, would you say that anything that he's written is valuable?
I think anything he wrote is valuable. I think everything he did on The Simpsons is valuable. I think we lost such an enormous brain trust when we lost him and Christopher Hitchens. Mm-hmm. Those two are devastating losses for the human race.
Except that they left behind a body of work.
And thank God, but there are so many times that I want to turn on YouTube and find Christopher Hitchens commenting on Now.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because I was thinking about how I wish that Kurt Vonnegut was putting something out right now. But then I read God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater.
And he already said it.
Yeah. Just so everyone listening, go read God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. That is right now, right here.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Honestly, pretty much anything that Kurt Vonnegut wrote is probably
relevant right now.
A good one. Yeah. I can't believe I don't have him on my list. I was in 8th grade when I read Cat's Cradle, and it changed my life, that book. I'm in 8th grade. I walked around saying, see? No damn cat, no damn cradle. And these kids my age would look at me and go, what the hell is your problem? But all the adults would be like, wait, did you read that book too? I'm like, all right, so you're my people. You stupid 8th graders can go off and...
I did that whatever with Breakfast of Champions, but I fortunately read it with a friend, and the two of us then we just have these little inside jokes, giggling. Mostly, actually, we just enjoyed his illustration of a beaver because we were in eighth grade. I think that's one of those books as well that you appreciate more as you get older.
Yes.
Like you appreciate the nuances a little bit differently. For other books like that, like what are some other books that you recommend that you think are books that a lot of people, like classic books that people might have been forced to read, that actually as adults they might enjoy better now because they have an appreciation that they didn't have?
That's a really, really good question. I think of the classics, especially the, well, I can tell you rather factually with support for it and everything. The stuff that we've done on my podcast, which all has to be classic because the texts are public domain, and so we don't have to pay for the audio. The books that I've gotten over the years the most email about as being either game changers for people because it turned the way that they saw the world differently, or life changers because they didn't feel excluded from conversations that would happen around them just kind of spontaneously. Mm-hmm. I remember I got an email from a listener probably 5 years ago who said that she was at one of her friends had dragged her to a Lyceum thing. It was just a night of people speaking. And she had thought, oh my God, this is going to kill me. I'll bring my knitting. So she had her knitting with her and she went to the thing, and the guy who was speaking, he was talking about Frankenstein, and I don't think she knit that night because she was so riveted, because he was saying similar things to the things that I had said on the podcast, but took them way further. Mm-hmm. And so for her, it was that we'd laid the groundwork on the podcast, and then she was able to go think really big thinks about this stuff that she wrote and said she never would have, she would have felt so excluded. But Frankenstein's a big, important book, especially now. Gulliver's Travels, I'm getting more emails from people saying, oh, it's the Yahoos. Yeah, sorry about that. I didn't know we were heading this direction. Jane Eyre, I think it's very easy to stereotype women. In fact, I was just talking about this today on recording the next episode for Craftlit. We're doing Count of Monte Cristo, and there's, of course, a young couple in love. And often in books from the 1800s, those are the melodrama characters. They're the stock characters who are young and beautiful and blonde and passive and all the ingenue things. Mm-hmm. And you think that's where they're going in this chapter, and it winds up not there. And you wind up getting a lot of really important characterization information about several different people who they either talk about or that you get from watching their conversation with each other. And she's no Lucy Manette. She's pretty tough. And Jane Eyre also is far, far stronger and more persnickety than I ever thought I would have seen in a book written back in 1830. So that was a big one. The Woman in White was the first time I saw one of the What Would Madame Defarge Knit books that we put out. One of the designers designed a particular cowl for the character in The Woman in White, Marion, and called it The Lady as a Ninja. Because she totally is in the book. She goes out in the rain in it's a huge thunder and lightning storm. She has to go and find out what the bad guys are saying. So she crawls out on a balustrade in the storm in a petticoat and her cape and goes shimmying along the balcony so that she can go and eavesdrop, manages to get back to her room, writes down what she's learned in her diary. And as she's writing, you can tell from the way the text is written, because it's brilliant, that she is starting to become very feverish. Mm-hmm. And she gets sicker and sicker as she writes. And then her text stops and the next page starts with the bad guy saying, oh, I love Miss Marion so much. She's such a strong woman and so fun to watch the things that she does, like crawling out to listen to me from her room in the dark. And you're like, oh my God, she must be dead. And I'm not going to tell you what she is, but but that's one of those most terrifying moments in the book when you suddenly realize that, oh crap, he just read everything she wrote down.
I think it's interesting you're talking about the expectations that people have, and there are tropes, right? There are always tropes. And I think also when you were talking about really classic things like Frankenstein, everyone thinks they know the story, or they think that they have a general, especially with the things that become classics where there's allusions to it within pop culture and conversation and films and stuff. So people think that they know it and they understand it, but it's very different when you read it in a different historical context.
Yes.
Or if you understand the historical context.
Yep.
And when you read it and look at what's not being said.
Yes. Oh, my good God, yes. Wow.
Yeah.
That was such a lesson.
Yeah. And there's so many books like that that you come to. And I know there's things that I've read when I was younger that I didn't even reread it. Just when I was older, I suddenly was thinking about some aspect of it. And suddenly I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Been there.
Yeah.
That is pretty much 90% of the reason why I started the podcast. Partly just because I love learning that stuff. My son is 16. I've been podcasting since he was 5. Pretty much every week. And he just, and I mean just last Friday, came in and said, because they just started Frankenstein in class. So he's about halfway through the book now. He came in and said, "So, Mom, when you do the podcast, you play the audio from the books, right?" Said, "Right." "And you talk, though, and you're not reading the book." I said, "No, I usually get audio from someone else because nobody has to listen to my voice for the entire hour. That's crazy." And he said, "So what do you say?" And I said, "Well, it's kind of like Cliff's Notes or Spark Notes or something like that, where I give you the history. You know, if you're going to miss a joke or you're going to miss an important turning point because you don't know the history, then I make sure I fill in those gaps. Or if there's a joke that hinges on a term that we don't use very often, or there's a cultural reference that we don't get, but it's a huge joke if you know what you're listening for." I always said when I taught, I was teaching to the joke, because what's the point if this stuff doesn't help you enjoy life more? So I said, I kind of do the Spark Notes beforehand, or Schmoop actually is probably more closer to my attitude. And he said, "Oh, that's a really good way to describe it." And I said, "You mean the way I've been describing it to you for the last almost 11 years? And he said, "Yo, I wasn't listening to you." But now he actually has a friend at school who's been listening.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is, I think it's also hilarious, not just because that's kind of funny, but it's hilarious because that's the first time he hasn't hidden me. So something, I don't know what switched. I don't want to ask.
Yeah, teenagers, they're complicated to try to understand them.
Yeah. No. So just enjoy the beauty.
What about humor? Because I think you've touched on like the joke, that's important. And I think that humor is a beautiful way to learn and to retain.
Yes, especially retain, because we're more likely to talk about the funny stuff, and what you talk about is what you remember. I think probably the biggest laugh I got recently, and by recently, I mean within the last 5 or 6 years, was Christopher Moore. I read everything by Christopher Moore, but the first one I read was Lamb, which is the gospel.
So good. The gospel according to Biff.
Biff, Jesus' best friend, Biff. Or Josh and
Joshua.
Biff.
Joshua. Yeah.
Joshua.
Made me and love the name Joshua, that book.
I'll tell you, I thought a bunch of people had recommended it to me, and I thought, "Oh, I don't know." And then I picked it up, and as I was going along, I finally turned to Andrew at one point and said, "There is nothing about Josh that is blasphemous. There is nothing about Joshua that doesn't fit the Bible." And he said, "No, absolutely not." And I said, "But Biff is a horn dog, and he'll, you know, drink anything, do anything, smoke anything, go anywhere with anyone. So he's fun." And you would think, given a dichotomy like that, that the poor Jesus character would kind of size up poorly, that he wouldn't be as much fun as a character. But there is something about what Christopher Moore did that I think is so, it's such a tightrope act, but it's also beautiful, and it's what makes the end work, because it's their relationship, these two guys, and Jesus is just a really great guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a really great guy.
He's really great. And also I think when you look at the relationship and the role that Biff plays, like Biff does all these things, but he does them because he wants to help Joshua understand. He's doing it to support his friend. He's not doing it out of some sort of self-gratification or just like he's not doing it mindlessly.
Not himself.
Yeah,
but there is a larger purpose to it.
Exactly. And he sort of understands that.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he doesn't quite understand why or what that purpose is, he knows that there's something bigger than himself going on.
Yeah. Which I thought, again, what a deft bit of writing. And also the amount of research that he must have had to do, and he's done this for several other books too, but the amount of research that he would have had to do to figure out what trajectory to put those kids on for the part of the Bible where, or for part of the New Testament where Jesus disappears from the narrative and then comes back. Where could they have gone? What could they have seen? And how could that have influenced a kid who grew up like this so that when he reemerges at what, 30, 32, he's this guy who sets the world on fire. You know, what is it that could do that? And I'll be damned if Christopher Moore doesn't make a really good argument, because the Kali worshippers at the end, I was weeping from that point of the book all the way up to the end, because all of a sudden I realized where we were and what was about to happen.
Yeah.
And then what was really about to happen. And I just wept for the rest of the book as though I didn't know what the ending was going to be.
I know, you really feel the connection that Biff has.
Yeah, it's like there's nothing, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter. It's beautifully written and hilariously funny.
Mm-hmm. I also appreciate that at the end he does, he puts that little addendum kind of, here's the research I did. Mm-hmm. Here's what's accurate. Here's what I changed in order to make a better story.
Yeah. And he did that with Fool as well, because the King Lear story, he changes the ending. Mm-hmm. And evidently there is absolutely a history of people doing that, both theatrically and in writing, regular writing, where they've taken the King Lear story and modified it. So he's not at all out of the norm doing that. He also did that with Sacre Bleu, the really vulgar story about the color blue.
Yeah. But he's quite vulgar. You probably put that as a warning.
Yeah,
Christopher Moore, he's fantastic and brilliant and delightful and funny, but vulgar.
Yes, really, really. Well, I think when my first introduction to him, it wasn't Lamb. My first introduction to him was You Suck, A Love Story.
Right, okay.
The Vampires.
Yeah, my first was Lamb, actually. And then I realized he had a huge body of work, and I was thrilled, because at that time I had this habit of finding an author I liked and reading everything they'd ever written.
Right.
And nothing else.
So, yeah, for a while.
I stopped doing that. I actually got out of the habit of that because of Terry Pratchett. Because when I found out that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I didn't want to read absolutely everything he'd written, because I knew that at a certain point now I definitely would reach the end and that would be heartbreaking. So as of right now, I've not read three of his books.
Did you read Good Omens with Neil Gaiman?
Of course.
That was actually my introduction to Terry Pratchett.
Is that right? And for me, actually, that was, I'd been reading Terry Pratchett for a while, but that was my introduction to Neil Gaiman. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting one. So talking about reading things when you're younger versus when you're older, I read that book when I was younger, living in Canada. Uh-huh. And then I reread it after living in the UK for 5.5 years, just towards the end of being there for 6 years. And it was way funnier, because there's a lot of jokes in there that you only get if you live there and you know the culture.
Yeah, well, especially, what is it, Crawley's greatest feat was the A5 that goes around?
The
M25. Yes. Going around London?
Yeah.
We were listening to the radio play version that Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman show up in.
No way.
Actually.
Amazing.
Yes, they show up as the cops, which is hilarious. Who stopped Crawley?
Wow.
And they're listening along, and because they are my kids, they know when they hear a joke that they aren't getting because they're missing a piece. Mm-hmm. So it's never, I don't understand, that's stupid. It's, I don't understand, what am I missing? And so, I went to my phone and I pulled up a a map of London. And I said, do you see the sort of circled shape kind of going around the city?
Yeah.
I said, yeah. I said, that's it. And they went, oh.
It becomes even funnier when you live there and you listen to people complain about it. And you hear stories about people who are not from London who get stuck on it because they don't realize it's a ring road.
Yes.
And the traffic that gets experienced on it, and the slip roads, and the M25 is legendary.
No, I think it is proof of Satan on Earth right there. I think that's all you need. I'm with them. Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett know what they're talking about.
They do. Moving on from Neil Gaiman, you have also recommended Sandman, specifically Seasons of Mists, although I'm a big fan of the entire thing. Could you talk a little bit about, because the graphic novel, okay, it gets classified as a comic book, and for me...
It came out as a comic book originally.
I always define, to me, the difference between a graphic novel and a comic book is I see comic books as like soap operas. So they have the set group of characters, but they kind of change over time. They might have different sort of manifestations, different storylines, but they just go on forever. But a graphic novel has a clear beginning, middle, and end. And so, yes, when Sandman started out, it could have potentially just gone on forever, but it now actually has set volumes and a clear beginning, middle, and end. But why specifically then, or maybe we should give some premise, anyone who's not read Sandman.
Oh, it's such a work of genius.
It is.
it's interesting that you preface it with that definition of comic books, because I definitely read comic books when I was a kid, like Archie and Richie Rich and stuff like that. And I did have access to some of the more quote unquote boy superhero-y kind of stuff. My mom had like old Superman comics too. So, I mean, they were all, you know, all this stuff was always around. My dad, of course, read stuff and they were fun, but I hadn't seen a comic book that looked like art before. And so to me, it wasn't so much the structure of the story as it was the seriousness with which the storytelling was, how seriously it was being treated. And it wasn't for kids necessarily. No. Not that teenagers wouldn't love it. And in fact, when I had disaffected teenagers in class who just sat at the back of the room and pouted or scowled, I would walk by and just drop Season of Mists on the table and keep going. And they, you know, after a while, they'd be like, oh, whatever. And they'd open the page and go, oh. Wait, what? And then, you know, the bell is ringing. I'm like, you have to go to your next class. What? No, 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 no. Can I keep this? Yes. Go ahead. Bring it back tomorrow. And it's, I think Season of Mists was unique among the Sandman graphic novels, because I did read this one. Actually, I have a signed copy by Neil Gaiman.
Amazing.
When it was released in hardback.
Breaking rights.
Oh my God. He was so beautiful. I had such a fangirl crush on him.
Easily done.
But I know he's just got such a beautiful mind and soul and everything. And it comes through in this book, this one particularly. He's always doing creative stuff. He always has his seven endless, which are Dream and Death, who are the two main ones that you focus on in the Sandman books. Dream is Sandman, Death, his sister, who is a little punk rocker girl with an onk and fabulous eye makeup,
kind of goth, so, but not actually very goth at all, because she doesn't throw shade.
No, she doesn't. She's really kind of chipper and funny, which I loved. So you have Dream and you have Death, and then you have Despair, who's exactly who you'd think it was. Desire, who's fabulous. It shows up as any kind
just
of desirable
androgen,
anything.
Really.
Yeah, and beautifully drawn in every single book that Desire shows up in. I'm always blown away. So you got Desire. You've got Delirium, who used to be Delight, but she did too many drugs in the 60s.
For whom my cat is named.
Oh, perfect. And then you have, let's see, Dream, Death, Despair, Delirium, Desire.
Destiny.
Destiny, who has the Book of Life.
Who is the oldest of them.
Him, and he's the oldest of all of them. And he's very somber. And Death finds him to be kind of boring. And
he's kind of boring.
Destruction. He is kind of boring. And then there's Destruction, who left the pantheon of the endless a couple hundred years ago to come and live with men on the earth, which gives you a really good setup for where the authors are coming from, the artists and the author. And so Season of Mists took that a step further. And actually, there is now a TV show called Lucifer, which is directly based on this Neil Gaiman Sandman book.
Amazing.
Because the whole premise in Season of Mist is that Lucifer is sick of it. He is sick of having humans die and show up in hell and say, oh, whip me, beat me, make me hurt. I was such a bad person. Oh, punish me, punish me, punish me. He's just done. He is so done. You make your own hell. You are hell. And I'm out of here. I've had enough. And he hands a knife, a ceremonial knife, to Dream, and has Dream cut off his wings, and he walks away, leaving the key to hell with Dream, saying, you figure out who to give it to. I don't care. And he takes off. And so Dream is stuck there in hell now going, well, what am I supposed to do with this? So he has, he kind of puts an APB out for anyone who wants the key to hell. Come and tell me why you think you deserve it.
And it's a very deep thinking kind of thing, right? And you really,
it's huge.
Put some sort of solidity around
many levels.
Yeah.
And from that point on, the resonances that go back to all of mythology just do not stop pouring over you, because you've got Thor, you've got Loki, you've got chaos and order, you've got Bat, you've got Anubis, you've got Chinese gods that I'd never heard of before. It is unbelievable.
It's like the most cameo filled.
It's a cameo for every world religion plus, because you've got chaos and order, which try and figure out how to draw that.
I know, right? Oh, that the art is
beautiful.
Really amazing. It's really
beautiful. And I think the ending is exactly right.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say anything more than that.
Say nothing more. Okay.
I just think it's beautiful and funny and heartbreaking and good.
Yeah, they're really, really good. They're the whole Sandman series, that one in particular. I like that you've picked that one out, actually, because I was thinking about because I've always read them in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
I've always seen them as...
It's not the first one by a long shot.
Yeah, and I've never thought of them as standalones, but I know that they can work as standalones. So that's a good jumping in point for people if they don't want to start from the beginning. And I know that they're widely available at libraries. Libraries are great.
Yes, they are. We love libraries.
Okay. Other recommendations. Where are we moving on to
American
next?
American Gods. So going off of Neil Gaiman, okay. American Gods, which is also coming up on the Stars Network. So read it before, because not because they're going to screw it up, because I actually don't think they're going to. Read it before, because they have actually updated parts of it.
Okay.
Because the book American Gods was written 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a time capsule, which is fine. But there are things that really did need to be updated. And I've read a lot about what Neil Gaiman has done to help them out with making changes and updates and stuff. And I'm very, very excited. But I think it will be that much richer an experience to watch and enjoy if you've read the book and you can see.
I find that that's generally the case. I'm usually one of those people who prefers to read before you see it. And I only recommend seeing it if you just don't really plan to read it. Another one that's being serialized that I've heard is coming out is Handmaid's Tale. I think BBC is doing it.
Yes. And Elizabeth Moss, who was Peggy in Mad Men, is playing the main girl in Handmaid's Tale. And I think she is a perfect casting. I did see a trailer for it finally.
Ooh.
So it's out there. It must be on YouTube at this point. And scary.
Yeah.
Scary good.
I only just finally read that recently. I know.
Damn.
I'm a bad Canadian.
That's okay.
Not reading Margaret Atwood.
She would understand.
I don't think she would. She's like if people are like, go ahead, name a famous Canadian.
Oh,
the only author they'll think of is Margaret Atwood.
Yeah, okay. She spoke at UCLA, though. I got to see her speak. I think she'd be gracious about it, but you're right. She would probably kind of grit her teeth.
Yeah, I got to see her speak at World Book Night in London, which was fabulous. And she actually read from Handmaid's Tale, but I hadn't read it yet. So, and it's one as well. It's held up well.
Yes, sadly.
Mm.
Scarily. Yes. As has Douglas Adams and Jonathan Swift.
They have right?
held up. They've held up far, far better than I wish they had. Although the jokes that Douglas Adams tells about digital watches, those are kind of getting a little dusty. But But there's an interesting confluence of Zaphod Beeblebrox's presidency and recent world events that Douglas Adams' commentary on Zaphod's presidency is, I think, valid and insightful and scarily predictive. But yeah, I think both of them are absolute geniuses, and largely for the same reason. They're far smarter in their humor than most people are in their smartness.
Humor is hard to do well. I have great admiration and respect for anyone who can write humor.
Yes. And Tartuffe.
Tartuffe.
Tartuffe has been relevant since 1980. It kicked back in. Well, it kicked back in with the Moral Majority, so maybe 82. But Tartuffe has not lost. If you can get a good translation, mm-hmm. even a lousy translation, but a good translation is brutal. And if you can get a good translation that has the original ending.
The original ending.
Oh, my God.
What's the key difference between the original ending, without giving it away, the original ending and the...
I think I could sum it up this way, mm-hmm. that the ending that most people would read in high school would be the TV movie of the week ending.
Okay.
And the original ending would be the off-Broadway scrappy version.
I see. Okay.
off-Broadway, even, maybe.
So the
possibly with nudity.
Happy, tied-up ending versus the mm-hmm. raw reality isn't necessarily so neat ending.
Yeah. And not only that, but the raw, oh, yeah, well, that's exactly how it would have played out ending.
Okay. I think we got to touch on it, 1984.
Right? I am starting a new podcast. I can't believe I'm doing this, but I'm starting a new podcast called Brave New Podcast.
Brave New Podcast. I like it. Okay.
So what it's going to be, because normally I do the talk in, the chapter audio and the talk out. I can't do the chapter audio for Brave New World or 1984 or for Eric Hoffer's book, The True Believer. Although we're still working on getting the rights for that in a trade. We'll see if they listen. But those three books, at least as a start, we're going to do on Brave New Podcast as a just the notes version instead of books. So it'll be every chapter will have an A chunk and a B chunk. So one A would be the notes talking you into chapter one. Mm-hmm. And then you could go listen to it on your own or read it on your own, whatever you want. And then the one B chunk would be the post reading.
Okay.
Here's what to make sure you don't forget about, because we're going to need it in three more chapters. And okay. We're going to go through those books because they're a little too important right now.
Yeah. I think with 1984 specifically, people get really hung up on the Big Brother thing.
Oh, that's not the important part.
No. What would you say is the important part?
I think Newspeak, which if you read it, well, I say you, what I really mean is when Heather read it in school, the thing that Heather remembered, of course, is Big Brother and Goldstein. But I remembered the terminology as being particularly compelling, the idea of doublespeak or doublethink. I mean, that stuck with me, and not just with me, but with everybody who I went to school with. Things happened in the 80s that it was very easy to point to and say, wow, that's doublethink. And that's pretty much where it stayed for me. But I went back and reread it last month two months ago. There are enormous chunks of that book where George Orwell goes into the planning behind changing a language. And it's not subtle and it's not frivolous. It is absolutely political and it is brilliant. And as evil a thing as you could hope to perpetrate on humankind, because it is impossible to think about something if you don't have a word for it. You might be able to think it, but you're not going to be able to communicate it or necessarily nail down what it is that's knocking at your brain.
Sorry, this is very funny because my very first thought there is like, aha. So if you are training in Buddhism and specifically in analytical meditation around emptiness, you would be able to challenge this and you would be a threat to such things. Because mm-hmm. I spend an awful lot of time trying to think about things that you cannot, that are totally ineffable. They are ineffable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think that that's the other thing is that there's a lot in what I guess, not an adult life, but I think a layered life, a life that is examined and pondered on, but not necessarily in a navel gazing way, but for the purposes of being able to come back out of that thinking and be better at being person, human person. And I think that even the things that are ineffable, the things that can't really find the right word, I think with poetry, with music, with art, and with language, there are ways that people have found to say incredibly complex things in ways that make other people respond either, I know what you mean, which is a great first step. Even if it's wrong, it's a great first step because there's some instinct towards empathy. Or, oh my God, I felt that way, which is a step closer. Or, I see myself in you, which is, I think that's the final, that's the closest you're going to get. Yeah. Because at that point, even if you can't find the right word to explain what it is or how you're feeling or what you want for yourself, for your children, for your family, for your friends, for the world, there are other ways that that information can be gotten across, usually with words, which are limited and limiting already. But there's at least hope that you can communicate something somehow. And that's going to get passed on, chances are, in even a flawed way with language. So when Orwell goes in and says, okay, well, if there's no word for freedom, then there won't be any freedom. And even more insidiously, I thought that was the most insidious, but the more insidious, I think now, is the 2 + 2 = 5. One day. Mm-hmm. And the next day, it's 2 + 2 = 3. And the next day, it's 2 + 2 = 4. Mm-hmm. It's the we're at war with Eurasia. We have always been at war with Eurasia. It's the we have a surplus of shoes. When Winston knows there isn't a surplus of shoes because he's the one who changed the numbers on the crop report.
Alternative facts.
It's funny you should mention that.
I appreciate what you just said about saying the 3 points and getting to the point of I see myself in you.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I think that is what compassion is. I think that people get compassion really messed up. They think compassion is about being nice to people or kindness. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, compassion isn't always kind.
No. And it's sure not easy.
And it's not easy. It's not easy. But it is that. It is seeing yourself in people that you don't want to be able to see yourself in. Mm-hmm. Because you want to say, no, I'm not like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're different, they're other, but understanding that any kind of othering of anyone isn't going to get us anywhere fast as a society.
I know some people have talked about that seeing yourself in someone else is the same as seeing the face of God. It's when you recognize the best in yourself and the best in someone else as being complementary, even if it's different.
This is the power of the written word that's really wonderful, right? And when you're reading something and you see yourself reflected back, or you see something that you've seen happening around you and it's articulated in the words on the page.
Yeah.
In a way that you hadn't been able to. Or you're just reading it and you're like, oh, this person has been there.
Yeah.
They genuinely know what this feels like because they've captured it so beautifully in words that I understand that they understand.
Yeah.
And I'm not alone.
Absolutely. And having somebody put this happened to me with my younger son yesterday. He said something that was so wise. And I looked at him and I said, wow, I sure didn't need to go to therapy all those years ago. I should have just waited until you were born and grew up to this point, because there you just summed that all up. And he gave me this funny look and I said, I'm not joking. You really just did. You kind of crystallized that whole thing and just presented it on the table like a little package, and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
These kids, I tell you what, they come out with amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, I mean, their father's a really, really, really good writer. And they have both inherited his facility for language and his facility for clarity.
Well, just inherited, or just, I mean, between the two of you as parents to teach this to them. Like, people are like, Mozart was phenomenal. I was like, Mozart was raised by somebody who
was
composed music, was phenomenal, had access to all these instruments. Mozart was not magical and did not happen spontaneously. We can all work to refine our understanding. What,
like Athena climbing out of Zeus, bounding out of Zeus's skull.
Yeah, that stuff doesn't happen. Oh, no. It sounds fun.
I know. Dicey.
Unless Zeus ended up with like a splitting headache, but probably easier for everyone. This has been great. Lots and lots of recommendations. Basically, though, people can just go to Craftlit.
Yeah.
Any of the ones that you mentioned that are public domain.
Yeah, basically. Right. I think we've done all of them, all of the public domain. Oh, and the one that we did as a premium book, and it's now in my shop, is a little rarely read Oscar Wilde kind of a novella called The Canterville Ghost. Mm-hmm. And it is probably the most heartbreaking redemption story I have ever stumbled on. He wrote it before he wrote any of his other stuff, his big stuff, Dorian Gray or anything like that, which is fabulous, but different. And it is a sweet and funny, almost Mark Twain-like in sections, but ultimately heartbreaking in a good way, kind of redemption story. Who knew?
We could all use a little redemption.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. It's a good place to head towards.
Thank you so much for listening. Visit craftlit.com, that's craftlit.com, to listen to Heather's podcast, which is a collection of classic literature readings and discussions to be enjoyed while knitting, cooking, painting, or simply for their own sake as the focus of your attention. To find out more about what I do, visit kaylinschatch.com, where you can read my blog, sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, and leave a tip to help support the show and other things that I do. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.